Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. On today's episode of Mysteries of the Ohio Valley, we're going to be continuing on our journey through the 1970s in western Pennsylvania and the surrounding tri-state between there, eastern Ohio, and western West Virginia, as a terrible run of murders had been taking place during the 1970s. And today, we focus on St. Patrick's Day of 1977, when Deborah Capiola, just 17 years old, going to West Allegheny High School near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, ended up going to her bus stop, but never made it to school. We'll look into the timeline. We'll look into the details. There's not a ton here in this one, but there is one really, really strong suspect that we will discuss here on Mysteries of the Ohio Valley. All right, everyone, welcome back to Mysteries of the Ohio Valley. My name's Nate Metz, your Cincinnati area-based podcaster, and on this show, I'm going to be talking about the Pittsburgh area yet again. Back in the late 1970s, there were a lot of murders that took place, and one of them is Deborah Capiola. She was 17 years old, blonde hair, shy, just adorable, a junior at West Allegheny High School. And she lived in Findlay, Pennsylvania, which is not really that far from Pittsburgh itself. It's near the Pittsburgh airport, I think is the best way that I can describe it. It kind of butts up to the Pittsburgh airport, close-ish to Moon Township and Robert Morris University, but that's on the other side of the airport. But it's not far from where Deborah Makel and Barbara Lewis and Susan Rush and Mary Gentse were living and then unfortunately dying. And Mary Gentse, I mentioned last week that I don't see her being tied necessarily to the string of murders. I think hers was a one-off situation. But this one, man, this one's awfully weird, awfully creepy, and I think it's time that we dive right into it. Now, in Findlay, Pennsylvania, she lived just on Point Park Road, which I was thinking, in my mind, it would be close to Point Park University, which is a college, a small college in the Pittsburgh area. And I had been there a couple of times, but I couldn't really remember. They were a big rival of my college when I was back in school. So I was thinking maybe it would be around there, but then I checked, and Point Park is actually on the opposite side of town. So not really sure how it got to be named Point Park Road, but I digress. She would walk up Point Park Road with her brother August every morning to wait for their bus. And it was only about a 5-minute walk from their house to the bus stop. So it wasn't really that crazy of a hike or anything like that. Now, it is around the Pittsburgh area and in the suburbs, meaning it's going to be a very wooded area. There are a lot of trees, a lot of places to hide. Now, she normally walked with her brother, but on this day, St. Patrick's Day of 1977, her brother was not able to walk with her. He was sick, and that is a coincidence that you can't overlook. With that, much like Barbara Lewis that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, she never made it to school. Deborah's mom stated that she found Deborah's books and her nursing scrubs in the road just after 8 a.m. Very strange indeed. She left her home at what, like 7:40, probably to go down, wait for the bus, hop on, and get right over to West Allegheny High School. So just very, very odd circumstances. Her brother doesn't go to school that day. This is the day that her books and her nursing smock is found in the road. A lot of things aren't adding up. And when she doesn't arrive at school and she's not found anywhere, that's when the searches begin. But unfortunately, there was no luck in the early part of the search. They waited over a week to find any additional evidence. And I got to be thinking in that situation for the family, I got to be feeling for the family, because that whole week is just hell, right? And it's going to be hell afterwards, because you know where this is going. But the just, I wonder how much hope there is. And I probably need to talk. I mean, I know enough of them now. I've had conversations with many, you know, family members of victims that we've covered on this show, that have been thankful for us being respectful. Unfortunately, there's too many true crime shows that don't, but I'm not going to get on my soapbox quite yet about that. But when I think about her family looking for her and things like that, this was out of the ordinary. She wouldn't skip school. She wasn't a kid that was necessarily into anything bad, right? She wasn't running around with the wrong crowd. We've talked about that. That happens sometimes. with young people, hell, anyone. You get in with the wrong crowd and some bad things can happen, but that really wasn't the case. Multiple witnesses stated that there was a maroon car cruising around the bus stop the morning that Deborah was taken. And it was also of note that the car had kind of like a vinyl top to it, which you don't really see a ton of nowadays, but back in the late 1970s, that was fairly common. But still, no sign of Deborah. That whole week goes by. 8 days in total had passed, and then some of Deborah's belongings were found in an area called Blue Lake. I guess some kids were playing, and it's getting to be late March at that point, so maybe it's a little warmer, people are going outside, and some kids find some belongings of Deborah. And these are just kids, they aren't necessarily a suspect in this case. Now, state game wardens that were in Blue Lake at that time or around that day stated that they saw a maroon car with a vinyl top twice that day. And then 2 days after, Deborah was found. She was near an abandoned strip mine. She had been sexually assaulted. She had been strangled with the pant of her blue jeans. And how many times now have we seen this same MO? Young girl goes missing. Young girl is strangled to death, sexually assaulted as well. The MO in the last case that we talked about, Mary Gentzy, totally different. Yeah, there was a sexual aspect to it, but the MO was not the same. There was no strangulation, right? And it was pretty clear, in my opinion, that the two suspects really were the ones behind it. It wasn't some serial killer that they tried to pawn it off on. But in this case, it makes me wonder. And at the end of all of these, when I'm done talking about all of them and I've given each case its due diligence, we'll take a step back and we'll take a look at, are some or all of these connected in some way? Let's continue. The police had one man in mind basically throughout the entirety of this investigation. They had multiple suspects. Of course, they looked into a lot of people, but their main suspect was a man named David Robert Kennedy. Now, on the day of Deborah's disappearance, Kennedy, who was 22 years old at the time, was 27 minutes late to work, which was very unusual for him. He was not a kind of guy that would show up tardy, that would be late to his job. He was working at the Air Force Reserves Base near Pittsburgh, where he was a mechanic. And I don't think if you're working with any kind of military organization, being late is necessarily something that you're going to be making a habit of. So he was from Washington County, where, again, almost all of these murders have been taking place. Not necessarily this one, but Washington County, very close to Pittsburgh. And with that, there were a lot of other suspicious things about David at that time that made police look further and closer to him. But the thing that police lacked, at least at the time of the murder, was any kind of evidence that they could use, hard evidence that they could use. They had some circumstantial stuff around David that they thought they could pin him to this murder with, but it just didn't really stick without any kind of DNA evidence that they could use. They had some DNA on the jeans of Deborah, which is just so, again, it's messed up. We've seen it happen time and time again. And 28 years later, so on November 21st of 2005, so we have to jump nearly three decades into the future from the point that Deborah was killed, David Kennedy was arrested and convicted for first-degree murder of Deborah Capiola. Now, in order to come down on him with this conviction, there are kind of two branches of evidence that they needed to really review and use. Now, I mentioned that there was some circumstantial evidence on David, and I think it's best if we kind of go down and break that down for you. So the first thing, I mentioned there was a maroon car with a vinyl top. It was near the bus. It was eyewitnesses pointed it at the bus stop or near the bus stop and at Blue Lake, where some kids found Deborah's belongings. It's not a coincidence that witnesses saw a maroon. That's a very specific color. A maroon vinyl-topped car at both of these locations, one where she was taken and two where some of her belongings were found. That just doesn't add up, right? That's not just someone's making this up, right? Those are very specific accusations or at least details that are used in accusing whoever owned a maroon car with a vinyl top. And not long after Deborah went missing, a coworker of David Robert Kennedy noticed that David had brought his car in and was removing a vinyl top from a maroon Oldsmobile Cutlass. Yeah. So on the day that David was late for work, mentioned that it's not really a habit of his, David claimed that he had a flat tire, which has happened to me a number of times driving across. I remember, not to get too far sidetracked, this stuff happens all the time. You know, you're driving, when I would drive across the Brent Spence Bridge in Cincinnati, when I lived in Covington and I worked downtown, literally my first exit was to get on to this big scary bridge. And on that bridge with thousands of people crossing every day, there were bolts and all sorts of nails on the road. And it all kind of gets shifted over to the right lane where I would end up getting on at. So I understand the struggle of getting a flat tire. That's a valid excuse, assuming none of the other pieces of evidence were true. But the police continued to question him about that. And David said that he stopped at the car dealership that morning, not a flat tire. So you have that kind of conflicting alibi, and that makes things look very, very ugly from a circumstantial perspective for David Kennedy. And in the early 2000s, finally technology caught up, and DNA evidence pulled from the jeans that were wrapped around Deborah's neck matched that of David Kennedy. So the circumstantial evidence checks out, DNA evidence checks out, slam dunk, this guy's guilty as hell. And is one of the scarier murderers that I have spoken about on this show. And I think that the mystery of the Ohio Valley aspect of this murder, and maybe the most disturbing part of this, is this the only murder that David Kennedy committed? Now, he often went out of the state for work, just in general, and that meant that he very well could be considered for some of the other murders that took place in Ohio and West Virginia that weren't too far away from Washington County. You have multiple murders in Washington County, some that we've spoken about already, some that we still will have to speak about in the near future. Now, he was profiled by the police as a stalker. That's what they described him as, because how else would you know that she was not going to be walking to school with her brother that day if he was not, you know, checking them out, you know, every single day, seeing, oh, well, she walks with her brother. The first time her brother's not there with her, bang, I'm going to get her. And then what? He does. So the police were thinking that he is a stalker, someone who cannot control himself just once, someone who more than likely would do it again and again and again and again. And in the wooded areas around Pittsburgh, I mean, there are dozens of places to hide. On every single street, behind all the trees, hell, thousands of places to hide. It's terrifying. Now, State Police Trooper Rebecca Loving led an investigation on Kennedy, and she would meet with Kennedy at times and things like that. And during the investigation, you would think before the investigation, things would be weird. Now, they were downright evil, even. But things got even more odd during the investigation. During a meeting between Loving and Kennedy, David Kennedy allegedly leaned in and told the state trooper Rebecca Loving in a very casual and friendly manner that, quote, he had been following her. And then he went on and named places that she was at, what she was wearing on that day. He was stalking the investigator, who was supposed to be watching and stalking him. So they were like watching each other through all of this. And for him to say it in a friendly and casual manner, very matter of fact, this is psychopathic. This is terrifying. Sociopathic, whatever it is, it's terrifying. This is so creepy. But thankfully, in 2005, the conviction comes down, and David Kennedy now is in a state correctional institute in Fayette, which is in the SCI Fayette, which is in Pennsylvania. Latrobe, maybe, I think is where that is. And I don't know if he's ever going to get out. I did do a look on the inmate lookup for Pennsylvania, the incarcerated in Pennsylvania, and I found him. And We're not done with David Kennedy. We're going to look over the next several weeks. Could he be tied into this? Because who knows if this was just a single incident. And there are five more weeks of madness that we're going to be talking about through Western Pennsylvania and the surrounding area in the 1970s. And, you know, the DNA evidence is something that we're going to have to really look hard at, because there was DNA left at almost all of the crime scenes, and not all of it necessarily links up to David Kennedy. We'll talk about whether there could be errors in the DNA. We'll talk about all sorts of different things when we kind of wrap this up and have a big conversation at the end. Actually, that's going to be around episode 100 of Mysteries of the Ohio Valley. I haven't really thought if I'm going to do anything special for Mysteries of the Ohio Valley. Maybe I'll get Devin to hop on. That'd be cool if she'd be willing to come back on and do a mystery with me. But with that, everyone, that's all I've got for this week's episode. There wasn't a ton of investigative work necessarily that had to go into this from a police perspective, because they had their guy right away. You know, they watched him. They did all that they could. I applaud the police, and I think they got the right guy. Now the question is, did this guy do more? Was it just this incident, or did he do more? Was he a serial killer? I know some members of the police force seem to believe so, that he could be. He has that serial killer makeup. I don't know. We'll examine more, and we'll talk more here next week. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. My name's Nate Metz. I hope everyone enjoyed this episode of Mysteries of the Ohio Valley, and I'll catch y'all next time. Later on, down the river.